Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Have you ever been in a truly frightening situation where you felt that you'd rather be somewhere else than where you are right now? Well, to the unfortunate people of Shishmaref, Alaska, that is now a way of life. What's amazing is that the story you are about to hear is happening in an American town, a village of 600 people who have lived in their place for thousands of years, until now, as the rising dangers from global warming wash away their land and their connection to it. Join us now as we head on up to the western coast to the island people of Shishmaref, Alaska, when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News. Shishmaref, Alaska, just may be the first American town forced to head to higher ground as a direct result of global warming. Following today's Nature News update, we talk with Lucy Inengowak as she shares an uncertain future for herself and her people. That's coming up, but first, the news. That Okefenokee swamp fire that managed to spread into Florida and continues to burn as we speak is now the largest wildfire in U.S. history since 1918. Following a couple of days of heavy rainfall, hopes are this 600,000-acre inferno may be coming to an end. Although wildfires are a natural part of the natural cycles of nature, some suggest that a fire of this magnitude in the eastern United States may be indicative of the effects of a warming world. Delegates from 171 nations convened at the UN Wildlife Conference meeting in The Hague this week and continued to promote two opposing solutions to the illegal trade in elephant ivory, which is closing in on a four-nation deal that just may permit the sale of 140 tons of ivory in the year ahead. That's 140 tons. This comes from the conference meeting known as CITES, C-I-T-E-S, or the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species. Primarily focused on African interests, two countries, Kenya and Mali, asked for a 20-year moratorium on ivory sales, stating that over 19,000 elephants were illegally killed by poachers this year, with much of the ivory being sold to good old Japan, which was allowed a one-time purchase of 60 tons of ivory. Meanwhile, the nations of Botswana, Namibia, Zimbabwe, and South Africa claim that keeping the ivory trade open will serve elephant populations well, as monies earned can be used for conservation projects. Meanwhile, thousands and thousands of elephants, enough to supply 140 tons of ivory a year, continue to die legally and illegally. And in India, tigers in reserves just keep on disappearing at an alarming rate to meet the demands of the illegal trade in tiger parts. Recent studies on tiger populations in the Buxa Tiger Reserve indicate that the numbers had plummeted from 31 last year to 6 this year. This follows on the shocking discovery that within the popular Sarska Tiger Reserve, there are no more tigers at all, following their being wiped out in 2005. And it is good to remember that there were an estimated 40,000 tigers in India 100 years ago. In 2001, the population was estimated to be 3,700. That number may be wildly misleading if these horrific illegal takings continue at their current pace. And like the tigers of India, the orangutans of Indonesia are falling like so many statistics as loss of habitat, poaching, and illegal collecting hit the orangutans directly. Recent estimates state that 7,000 Sumatran orangutans and 50,000 Borneo orangutans exist in the world, but as we are learning so painfully, the numbers are crashing with each new census. With illegal logging somehow continuing at an astonishing 88% of all logging in Indonesia, There is little doubt that the plight of the orangutan will likely not even be considered in the years ahead in the $4 to $5 billion a year illegal taking of lumber. Caribbean and Central American sea turtles are swimming in troubled waters too, as all six species are endangered or critically endangered. Caught for their shells, meat, and eggs, the turtles are being taken, often illegally, in increasing numbers. A recent report stated, for example, that essentially all eggs laid in Guatemala had been taken by humans. That does not bode well for the future of sea turtles. The host of the Wildside News announced this week that if these trends continue, the world is headed for what could be a very serious wreckage of the fabric of life. He stated that the illegal taking of the wild creatures has reached pandemic levels and that people concerned about their welfare, health, and happiness, and their children's future as well, need to unite to stop it. And he urges the people of Japan, in particular, to fix whatever it is about their society that seems to be so numb to whole regions of spirit as to continue to permit such wanton takings from the dwindling wealth of wonder. And in the U.S., the BLM has approved extensive oil and gas leases in the environmentally sensitive Rhone Plateau in western Colorado, despite the objections of Colorado's governor and members from its congressional delegations. Drilling is expected to begin next year, and it has been ruled that all leases must be drilled by a single oil and gas operator. And who is that operator? It will be a big operator. And finally, when you think about human history, how far back do you generally consider? Some will easily count backwards 2,000 years to the time of Christ and the Romans. Others will continue counting backwards to China and Babylon and Ur, perhaps 5,000 and 6,000 years or so. New Agers and other psychic speculators will point to references of Atlantis and Mu, say, 10,000 years ago, when the glaciers melted and probably sank thousands of cities around the world. And anthropologists will point to Clovis Man at 11,000 BC, and even some early cave tools at 20,000 BC. Well, that was then, and this is pre-then. Scientists have discovered prehistoric shells in Morocco, with holes drilled for stringing onto bracelets and necklaces and possibly colored with red ochre dating from 82,000 years BC. As we debate our fate due to global warming, human greed, a divine plan, or just the way things are, let us realize, although it may be small consolation, that this has all occurred thousands and thousands of times before. And that's the news. A few reminders. Next week, I'm happy to announce that we'll be bringing you an update on a story I did over 3 years ago. It is perhaps one of the most explicit proofs of the communion we can share with another species. Be sure to tune in next week as we get an update from David Ball and his canine companion, Hawk. And please keep spreading the news about the Wild Side News. Send out an email today, even while you listen, with a link to www.wildsidenews.com. Thanks. And now on to today's feature. A lot of people talk about global warming. It's becoming a much bigger issue around the planet. But for most people, it's just something we talk about. We have little signs of it here and there, or major signs, depending on your perspective. But the truth is, on this planet, there are people who are being affected by global warming. And so now we're traveling up to Alaska, very far north, to a village, the village of Shishmaref. And joining us now from Shishmaref is an elder there and a resident, Lucy Iningawuk. Lucy, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you.
Tell us what you can about Shishmaref. This is a native village that goes back many hundreds of years. What can you tell us about your people and your history there?
It dates back thousands of years, and it has several sites, that community down at the west end and on the east end, and currently in the center of the island.
Is that part of the legacy that is discussed amongst the elders and others that they pass on to their children?
Yes, they told us stories of what might happen in the future.
And those stories were really quite interesting in terms of what may happen to the seas. Can you share some of those?
There was an airport being built in the 60s, and it went right from the ocean side to the lagoon side. And that was our first airport, and one of the elders at that time in the 60s stated that it'll eventually turn into a river from one side to the other.
And did that happen?
It hasn't yet. It's still, majority of it still intact, but a lot of the edges are gone.
It's going to be an interesting discussion because Shishmaref is trying to determine what to do. Why don't you share with the listeners what is happening to Shishmaref and what your experience has been throughout the years? When did you first sense that something dramatic was happening to the island?
I think it started in the 70s, early 70s, when we had our first, when I first saw a storm in Shishma. We've never seen parts of the land just going away with the ocean. This was in 1973 when my grandmother was still alive.
You were on the island at that time?
Yes, we were on that island at that time, and the waves were really huge. I've never seen them that.
How big would you say
they were? Like 5-foot swells or more.
Mm-hmm.
And after that storm, they didn't know how to protect the island, so they tried sandbags and, they tried 55-gallon drums along the edge of the bluffs over where it was hit the most.
The population of the island is around 500, between 500 and 600 at this time.
I think we were like 300 then, because we average about 20 new babies a year now.
Uh-huh.
So we're about over 600.
Uh-huh. One of the things that is a big issue is the fact that you make your living, it's a subsistence living to a large degree, by relying on the ocean for much of your food. Why don't you discuss the significance of sea ice? Because a lot of the problems that you're experiencing right now have to do with the fact that the sea ice is changing so dramatically.
We've seen a real dramatic change this year. Usually by May, month of May, we have our main subsistence season started, but we have finally gotten, this is in June now, yesterday we finally get an ukuk. It's a bearded seal that our people use year-round to sustain us.
The ugruk, is that how you say it?
Yes.
The hooded seal.
Yes, uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bearded seal, and they finally catch one. Usually in May we catch our enough for the winter, but we finally caught one yesterday. The ice is just staying around Shishmaref and can't seem to go away.
The ice isn't going away?
I know. It's real thin and rotten, but it's just hanging on.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, in terms of the ugruk, the hooded seals, how would you traditionally hunt for them?
Traditionally, they use dog team and go out in the ice and hunt them. At that time when I was growing up, they were using rifles then. And now they're using boats. Smaller boats to go out there, and they're finally able to go out yesterday. So,
because I'm not there, and I'm not a seal hunter. I know in some cases people hunt by waiting for them to surface through holes through the ice. Is that what you would do, or would it be more like you were hunting the seals on the surface of the ice?
They're usually either on top, or when they use boats, they just catch them when they show their head up from the water.
Now, I know in the past, for years, you used to use snowmobiles to head out onto the sea ice. And I understand that that's becoming impossible or dangerous.
Yes, right now. The ice conditions, they're really not for snow machines. It depends on the ice condition.
So now, because the ice is so thin, you're having to use boats as opposed to either dog sled or snowmobiles. You've had to abandon those approaches to catching the seal?
For this year, prior years they used snowmobile.
Mm-hmm.
We don't hardly use dog teams anymore, except for us.
We're going to go back a little bit and talk about how your island and your people are being hit. There was the big storm back in 1973, And that storm took out a significant portion of the island. I know that I've looked at, for example, images of the houses there. And how far away was the ocean at that time from your houses?
Probably about 200 feet, maybe 200-300.
That was back in 1973.
Yeah.
And then with that big storm, how much of that land disappeared?
About half of it, about 150 feet.
Wow, from one storm. Mm-hmm. And what time of the year was that?
Fall time.
Fall?
Fall time, yes.
Well, since that time, your shoreline has been decreasing, and why don't you discuss where things are now in terms of the houses and some of that history?
After the 1997, I think, we had to move 18 homes that were endangered by the ocean, the waves. We had to move them to the old airport and to get them out of harm's way.
Because the land had literally been eaten up almost to the edges of those houses, right to the houses themselves.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And the sand is so fine, it just melts with the ocean water and disappears.
Right, and we'll talk about that too, and that's the permafrost. How are things today? Because 97 was about 10 years ago. Now what's the status? How much of the land has disappeared since that time from the oceans?
They're encroaching to our own residential homes, which used to be like nothing to worry about in the 70s.
Right, because you had that 200-foot buffer. But now they're literally almost at your back door.
Yes.
Yeah. I have to believe that that has to be a very frightening situation for you and your people. I would think that you live in fear that another storm could conceivably really, really devastate and perhaps even kill people.
I hope we don't get to that.
I agree with you.
That, yeah.
But that is a fear of yours. I mean, it's a real fear of yours, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Mm-hmm. What do real people do, like yourself, in that situation? What are your options at this point?
Our options are to try to keep our families and people together.
There certainly is talk of the fact that you can't. You feel as if it isn't safe necessarily to stay at Shishmaref any longer.
Yes, we just need the time to have the community select a site that they could relocate to, and we want to remain together as Inupiaq of Shishmaref.
The island itself lies about 5 miles off of the mainland. Are you looking at places along the mainland to relocate to higher ground?
Yeah, we have 2 potential sites that had soil studies done. We had east soil studies from all the way from the west side to the mainland and then on to the east side. And there were 9 sites that were studied that would be adequate enough for us to move to. And there was 2 sites that the soil studies findings were good enough for us to move to.
How does the village discuss this? How do you actually talk about that and sort of how do you make a decision? That's a very dramatic decision.
The entities in Shishmaref, they formed a Shishmaref Erosion and Relocation Coalition, which consists of the native village of Shishmaref, the Shishmaref City Council, Shishmaref Native Corporation, and kind of combine all the entities that provide service to our people in various ways and combine the efforts and form the coalition to combat our cause in trying to find a safer, more stable site to move our people. And there was a vote in 2004 to relocate the community. We did a vote in the community.
That's a difficult thing to do. It takes a lot of money. You're one of the first true villages that is feeling the need to have to move because of global warming. How does it make you feel about this situation, and to what degree do you sense that the world should help you out?
I think our people want to remain together, and that's our number one reason why we're trying to move more inland, to remain together as one people, rather than being dispersed to other communities as
You would have to, at that point, just literally abandon your homes and your lands, and then somehow, I'm just trying to figure out how that's done. Are people suggesting that you may be given land, or would you have to purchase land? I mean, you have to abandon your literal land and your homes. How do you do that financially? What's the strategy there?
The potential relocation site is within the Shishmack Native land.
Uh-huh.
So just not really a issue here.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's good. Yeah, that helps. But then you have to build as well.
Yeah.
How soon do you expect that you may have to do that?
Well, we had projected at least a good 15 years in the early 80s. So we're attempting to work on securing the site with other agencies that work with us mm-hmm. in the region.
Well, now let's talk about personally. I try to put myself in your position and try to imagine how it would make me feel to have to abandon my land, my home, and move to another place. I mean, I don't exactly know how I would feel about that. So I'm curious how you feel about that and what people in Shishmaref are saying about this whole situation.
I feel that it would be keep our community together. This island is really getting very small enough to where we don't have any more space to provide for our children that are becoming adults to, there's no suitable sites for them to build their homes here, so going more inland would provide that for our children.
Well, that's very interesting. In that sense, it could be, although it's painful and difficult, it may be just time for that, for your people to expand and to feel more comfortable in their place. In terms of the Shishmaref and what is happening, has there been a sense of sort of being, what shall I say, attacked by nature, attacked by the seas, the sense of insecurity as a way of life?
Yeah, we can feel it every day.
Every day.
Especially now in this time of the year, we're kind of not really into the ocean melting.
I know that because it's a 5 mile distance between the mainland and Shishmaref, if there were a major storm, you'd be in a very difficult situation because you couldn't literally head off the island to protect yourself.
We just have to make do with what we have here, I think, to try to protect all our people here.
Mm-hmm. Well, very interesting. And it's very challenging. Because of the issue of global warming and climate change, do you sense that is what is causing this, that the climate itself is changing?
I think so. We've always had permafrost, and we always had, in the long run, it helped us, you know, the permafrost. It stayed intact and never was a problem to us. It provided for keeping our subsistence food, you know, preserved and more readily able for us to use our own subsistence foods that we traditionally use them. Now we have to try to beat the warmer climate. We have to work on our bitter seals in a different fashion. We have to kind of make them faster and a learning experience for us. Sometimes it's so warm that we sometimes we don't have our food done properly because of the heat used to being cold.
Yeah, the permafrost is a huge issue because in the past the ground was literally frozen all the time. That's why it's called permafrost, obviously. Because of the climate change, the ground is softening. And therefore, homes don't have the same foundation. And that's also, that. Besides just the storms, it's this issue of the permafrost also, isn't it?
It just melts with the sand just melts with the ocean,
yeah.
The water.
Well, here's a question. Now, when you think back, I grew up in Minnesota, which is possibly almost as difficult as Shishmaref at many times because of the snow and the cold and the winters and 30 below and 40 below and 60 below. So I can understand what it's like to experience winter. But when I talk with people from Minnesota, they say the winters aren't as difficult as they used to be. It doesn't get as cold. it doesn't get as cold for so long, and it seems as if spring is coming earlier and winter seems to come later. When you think back to your memories as a child, for example, can you sense that there has been a shift in those dynamics, the cold, the winter, the coming of spring?
Yes, there's a definite shift in the cold. By November, we used to have the ocean frozen by then, and nowadays it barely freezes until before Christmas.
And that's a dramatic change. Tell me more about what you noticed, what you personally have experienced in terms of those changes.
We had to learn to make adjustments on how we do our subsistence and when to keep warm. And majority of it is our subsistence foods. We have to learn the new warmer climate.
That will have to change even if you head to the mainland. So your lifestyle is going to be impacted by this. Were you able to kind of store your food outdoors in some sort of structures to keep them throughout the winter and into the summer?
Yeah, we used to do that, and now we have freezers. So, But our main concern is that we in Shishmaref, here in Shishmaref, would like to stay together, and wherever we move, we remain together.
How would you actually make that move? Would you do you sense that the village would make that decision and move sort of all at once, or would you start a building process and move a few people at a time?
I don't know how it's going to be, but they're doing wind studies, and the wind studies are completed because they're going to use the Shishmaref studies done prior years to make an airport up there, and we have one lonely mountain that's close by. And we'll be using the gravel from that to kind of provide a road from that mountain to the relocation site, and then continue to use gravel to make roads to the edge of the land, and then hopefully we'll be able to move our people somehow.
Now, I'm just curious, too. Once you relocate to the mainland, and I believe that is something that you really believe you have to do, is there a road that connects to your village, or do you have to rely on airplanes to bring in supplies and things?
That's all we do, is wait for airplanes. And sometimes in the summertime we have barges that bring in fuel, mostly fuel and gas.
You really are running a balance between reliance on the sea to provide you with the food, and then as well that which comes in by airplanes. So I suppose, therefore, the move has to be preceded by the airport, as you say. Well, you know, this is interesting because a lot of people are talking about global warming, and it's seen as and perceived as a huge, almost a threat to humanity. But I've always said I do believe that when people are faced with these dangers, they will figure out a way to accommodate. You know, they won't just, you know, stand and let the storms take them out. And that's what you're doing. Yeah. It's very, very interesting. In terms of the world, how do you want them to see you, and as well, is there anything that you can do, or do you wish to kind of handle this on your own?
We accept any kind of assistance that anyone offers us to make sure that we relocate all our people in one site, and that's how we want to be, is remain together as Shishmaref.
What types of things do you feel would be most useful to you?
Our main concern is that we stay together and not be dispersed to other villages or other towns, because we've seen that happen in Nome, when a village had to be moved to Nome, and they're kind of put on one side of the city, and they continue their own subsistence, but they're kind of not really home.
Well, I totally understand what you're saying, that I believe that it's wonderful that people have such a diversity of lifestyles, and some people interpret that in different ways, but the truth is they all have extraordinary value and significance and the right to continue to exist. Some people may not understand that, but I totally support your desires to maintain. And if you were integrated, for example, into a larger city, your way of life and your people would totally change, and you know that, don't you?
Yes, we've seen it. So.
Yes. Well,
we listen to our elders, and they want to remain Shishmaref.
Well, I wish you extraordinary success. I wish I knew how better to serve you. Are you getting help then from the U.S. government or others in terms of this process of relocation? How are you being assisted?
We have some help through some agencies that are able to provide the assistance, like soil studies. Mm-hmm. And we have some agencies that have to provide for some of the needs that we will need at the new site. Hopefully everything will come into play and we'll be able to move our people soon.
I have to imagine a lot of this would just depend on money as well, finances.
That you can discuss with our main personnel that handles that. I'm just a chairperson for the coalition.
Okay, very fine. I wish you the greatest success. Maybe someday, if I'm lucky, I'll be able to come up and visit Shishmaref and with your people. I so honor your efforts to keep your traditions alive. I think as globalization tries to wash away all of these unique qualities of people and turn them into sort of one generic style of society, I'm totally opposed to that because I believe that in the diversity, we can all survive better. And you're a living example of that, but now being really challenged by, the effects of globalization. We're talking with Lucy Iningawak from Shishmaref. Lucy, I want to thank you so much and wish you a great success, and hopefully you won't have any bad storms this season.
All right. Thank you very much. Bye.
And does it even matter if I sing? If I sing? If I sink or swim?
The truth is, we are playing games with the truth. Because I follow in the footsteps of Mr. Wizard, I try not to be alarmist. But at the same time, real science says that we are throwing off the balance of life on Earth. It's a cosmic experiment in wonder gone wrong. We have the power to make it right. Do the right thing. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet again next Thursday or anytime on the archives when your voice of the earth will bring you the latest and most important stories on earth here on the Wild Side News.
Here comes the water. Should I struggle or give in? Does it even matter if I sing?